The San Diego Housing Federation's annual Ruby Awards is the county's largest affordable housing community recognition event. They'll honor the best people, projects, and achievements from the past year. Join the awards on June 6th at the Marriott Marquis San Diego Marina. Early bird pricing is available until April 12th. Secure your tickets today at housingsandiego.org. That's housingsandiego.org. This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning. This podcast is sponsored in part by Intesa Communications Group, a women-owned PR and government relations firm that helps you communicate and advocate with confidence. Intesa colleagues are deeply ingrained in the issues and communities you care about most. From universities and nonprofits to corporate developers, theme parks, and tech titans, Intesa helps thoughtful leaders from all sectors shape San Diego for the better. Learn more at intesacom.com.
I made my own peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
You seem like you would be a sassy child.
You didn't
deny the Power Ranger thing.
I'm a little older for Power Rangers, frankly.
I tried to go one level beneath me, and that didn't go far enough.
Yeah, no. Like Ninja Turtles.
Okay.
Yeah.
TMNT.
Yeah. You could see that.
X-Men Saturday morning cartoon. Mm. That was a winner.
I watched Totally Spies.
Okay, I don't even know what that is.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 KOGO. I am Scott Lewis, the CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice of San Diego. I'm joined, as always, by Andrew Keats, managing editor at Voice of San Diego. What's up, Andy?
Scott, how you doing, pal?
Pretty well, thank you. And fellow managing editor, Andrea Lopez Villafana, is back. ¿Qué tal?
It's good to be back.
Yeah, how do you feel?
Feeling very tan.
Yeah? Nice. Coming up on the show this week, it was a big week in the news, not necessarily a great week in the news for San Diego State University. Officials there are facing tremendous pressure to account for the university's response to an alleged sexual assault by football players. And all of that was blowing up when the Aztecs played their much-anticipated first football game in the grand opening of the new Mission Valley Stadium, Snapdragon Stadium, which turned into something of a fiasco. Probably be mad at me using that word, but it's a mild fiasco. And SDSU announced plans as well for a satellite location in Chula Vista. A city council committee and the state of California have given green lights to the mayor's preferred team that he wants to redevelop the city's nearly 50 acres of land at the sports arena site. We will talk about how we got here, what's next, and some controversy about campaign financing and other issues that have come up. We'll explain what we know and are learning. And finally, education reporter Jacob McWinney is going to join me to discuss candidates and the profiles he did of them for the San Diego Unified School Board. It's going to be a great show. Stay with us. It's time to get your tickets for the next live podcast. That will be our kickoff event for PolitiFest 2022. It is PolitiFest South, happening in Chula Vista at the Emo Brown headquarters. We're putting on a two-part podcast that night featuring the candidates for National City and for Chula Vista Mayor, the mayor's offices for both cities. They're going to argue. They're going to talk. We're going to get them to reveal their deepest, darkest secrets. We'll have live music, food trucks, beer, and great politics. We have limited tickets for that event. Of course, we'll broadcast it later, but if you want to come see it, maybe be part of it, get those tickets while you can. Go to politifest.org. And you can check out everything else we have going on that week, too. We just confirmed Sean Elo Rivera, the council president, city council president, who will debate the CEO of the Taxpayers Association, Haney Hong, about the proposition, or the measure, excuse me, to change the city's people's ordinance. That's the one, of course, that guarantees no special fee will be charged to collect your trash if you can get it to a street. I nailed it again. Wow. Really on a roll.
On fire.
Get your tickets, politifest.org. That's politifest.org, P-O-L-I-T-I-F-E-S-T.org. Check it out. You can also go to PolitiFest South in the days before. Lots of great discussions and our most pressing issues and conversations coming up. So I think it's going to be the best one ever.
It would be stupid for us not to say that regardless. Because no one can attend any of the old ones
right.
between now and November.
Right. That's politifest.org. So I was in a very busy room and my phone made a just hideous noise and everybody's phones made the noise.
Mm-hmm.
This was Tuesday night, Tuesday about 5:30, 5:40, 5:50, something like that. Just everybody's phones alarm, like it was like somebody's kidnapped, something bad's happened, a nuclear attack is coming.
Was it the same sound that like the Amber
it
Alert
is.
Makes?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
And now I noticed not all phones did it. Some just buzzed. Mine made the sound, but the guy next to me, he just got a buzz. So I don't know how that's all determined or whatever. But it said, hey, we're about to hit the limit of what this power grid can provide as far as electricity. You need to try to turn some stuff off. And I had literally been about to tweet something good. And I was like, I'm going to hold back. So I don't need the Twitter servers to blow up. And but no, I one of the things I've been clued into that day was the California Independent System Operator, the sort of overseer of the entire power grid for this state, had a great website where you can track the power demand and how it's being met, like what sources of power.
This is what we always talk about. We just want omniscient data opportunities, and that's like what this is.
It's so cool. I immediately went to it, and it showed the power demand peaking at higher than it had ever been.
Oh my
more
God.
People were using more electricity than ever before in California. And that's one of those ever befores you can say because they didn't have power before they kept track of it.
Right. Now, that stands to reason, though, right? That if it's an all-time high temperature and our population is bigger than it's ever been.
And the economy's more active than ever before.
And the economy's more active than it's what we would expect.
Sure.
Right?
The thing is, right after that alert went, it just, the demand plummeted. It was like a straight line down for a little while. It was fascinating. And they kept the lights on. And I was like marveling at just this ability to watch the economy, the infrastructure, everything just kind of happened in front of on your screen. Like you said, this sort of omniscience that you can get just watching it. And anyway, I thought it was
sort of like that first week or two of the pandemic when we were looking for the real-time economic indicators from things like hotel room nights,
traffic,
mm-hmm. And you could see things happening instantly,
like the total financial collapse.
Now this is by the minute. Now this is by the minute, so it is quite a bit, more direct than even that. But
I saw the front page Sunday of the Union Tribune, and it didn't look good for San Diego State University. So on the one side is this story about this alleged sexual assault that several football players participated in, allegedly, and how the university is handling it or not handling it well. And next to it is a photo of dozens of empty seats at the brand new football stadium that San Diego State built, Snapdragon Stadium, and it's the grand opening, and it was empty. And I took a picture of that screenshot, and I sent it to the Twitter and said, "Seems like a brutal day in the news for San Diego State." And a lot of people were mad at me, like I did that front page. I didn't pick that photo.
Yeah, it was an odd reaction, as though like media relations isn't a field that exists that would react to something like the combination of that photo and story on an above the fold Sunday newspaper, right? Yeah. Like that seems relatively uncontroversial that would be bad for a single public entity to experience both of those stories simultaneously.
When you tweeted that out, did you think that would happen? Or were you just like, oh, interesting observation?
I mean, it does show how influential I am that me that me recognizing
this front page
the truth of something like that is uh-huh. is itself considered so negative that they'd yes. like to shield that level of sort of but, you know, but impact lest, from happening.
Lest we give you too much power to have this observation, KPBS, a news agency headquartered on San Diego State
Let's
University's
be clear,
campus.
It is a department of the university. The leadership of KPBS reports to the president.
Yes. That news agency wrote a story talking to attendees of the game about how unbearably hot it was, leading to the poor optics of a mostly empty seating area during the debut of the stadium. So keep in mind, this is all coming on the heels of an entire week of national attention on the handling of this sexual assault allegation.
So John David Wicker, the athletic director for the San Diego State University, had a press conference where he was he has to deal with some of these. Now, he acknowledged that like up to 20 people were taken away to get medical treatment. There was like 200 calls for help. There was obviously the visual, but it was also just bananas hot. It was so hot. Yeah. But this was his like take, and his take was that we don't know how to handle things in San Diego.
It's hot for this region. It's not. I grew up in Mississippi. We went to football games at 12:30 in the afternoon, and it was 90% humidity. But you know, it's what you're used to, and you know, hopefully, we won't see this very often for Aztec game, football games or any events at the stadium.
Now, he had just acknowledged this was the hottest San Diego State football game ever. It's the hottest September day ever in San Diego. And I got to say, like, I've heard this a few times now, and there is something about the sun in midday in California, especially in this time of year, when it is hot like that. It feels like it's searing your skin. It's not like I understand. I've been in the South before, but I don't think it's a wise idea to say, like, you guys just can't handle it.
Yeah, I hate it. You hear this take in San Diego all the time. Like, people in San Diego just don't know how to drive in the rain.
Yeah,
that's a cousin of this take here. And I hate it all. It's like, first of all, that's not how weather is experienced. The fact that I grew up in Maryland and experienced like more extreme cold than heat has no relationship to the way I experience weather today. That's not how it goes. Your body doesn't have like a memory of 15 years ago when I was colder than I am now or warmer than I am now. So it doesn't matter. And second of all, like, people are going to the hospital. What are you talking about? Like, they just need to be tougher? It's like meathead football guy mentality.
Yeah.
Like, there's 200 calls for help. 20 people are being taken to the hospital. There were like viral TikToks of people on gurneys. Like, what do you deprive your athletes of water when they're thirsty too?
Yeah. So I think we're all on the same page there. It was really hot. Now, the question was, I think one of the problems was they deferred and said, like, it's too expensive to put up, like, canopies or shade, which I agree with. Like, I don't think you can fully protect a football stadium from shade. That's fine. But to go right to there, I think, is like a little bit of a leap of comfort. Like, well, what do you want us to do? We can't shade everybody from this. But the biggest question is, why are they playing a football game at noon in September? Like, September's always hot in San Diego. It's not a weird thing mm-hmm. for this to happen. So the answer to that is TV.
Television dictates game time. And so this was, it's one of those things. It's one of the, I'll admit, a little bittersweet that you had the most coveted television slot in all of college football, the 3:30 Eastern, 12:30 time slot, but there was no conversation with moving the game time back based on, you have a TV window to fill there.
There was no conversation. It was not even considered that, even though they knew that this was coming as far as the heat, and not even saying like in September it's warm, like the heat wave was predicted. It was just not a conversation. That's like as illustrative as possible about college football right now and how big a deal these contracts and these TV deals are.
Yeah, and I mean it's a calculation. There's a trade-off.
Was it a good show though to like put that on, mm-hmm. even with the consequences? Like, was it worth the show?
And are the benefits of being in that coveted time, that most coveted of time slots, worth the front page newspaper clip the next day?
Right. Well, it's, or can you just blame the paper for doing that to you?
Or one order down, a blog operator who tweeted something about the paper.
Nice. Nice.
This all just makes me think of my Uber driver from a couple months ago when we drove past the stadium. And I was like, that's terrible. They look like bleachers. Like, there's nothing to cover people from the sun. And he was like, oh my God. Oh my God. You're right. I've never thought about that before. I wish I could just meet that man again.
Yeah.
And see if he saw this photo.
Yeah. Did you feel like you saw this coming? Like, you
yeah,
were ahead
of I was it? Actually going to tweet at you when I saw that. But this, I was still in Hawaii.
You
so you I was like, it was
3 a.m.
I was like, drinking pina.
Well, you're actually an alum too. You can say things. You put your time in there.
Yeah.
I think all of this, of course, is pales in comparison to the nightmare that they're dealing with this alleged sexual assault. There are so many questions coming up about why it's taken now. What we're at month 9 or 10 of no charges since then,
no arrests.
The entire California State University system is under a microscope about what happened. Did they respond enough? And we were just collecting our like 15 questions about that have been unanswered still since then. This is not going away from the university. But it then led into yet another announcement, another bit of news from the university. You've been following this. You've been following the mayor's race in Chula Vista and talking about how over the last 20 years they've talked about wanting a university in the land that they've set aside in Chula Vista for a university.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's finally a university going to do something there?
Yeah, so San Diego State is moving its like TV media production program to Chula Vista. And it's all being done in collaboration with the city of Chula Vista and Southwestern College. But, you know, it's not like it comes with housing. It's going to be this program. So it's different from what, you know, Chula Vista has talked about for like 30 years, actually bringing a university. But I think like city officials are seeing this as a sign that, you know, they can bring universities and university attention in different ways. But it does still bring up a lot of questions. I think like I saw earlier on Twitter, our good pal Adriana Hildiz was tweeting about it because, you know, she lived in Chula Vista and we both went to San Diego State together. And she was like, that's like pretty bad traffic if the classes are in the afternoon and, you know, you're living in San Diego State. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. But certainly the city has talked about this for years.
Yeah, I've always wondered that about universities, like when they do these satellite locations and such. Are they expecting people to go between campuses or to have a existence only at that remote location?
And it's tough to imagine because like film and TV is the type of thing that you could have like an early in your, you know, an early coursework elective.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Not a major course. Well, like, sure, if you're a senior and you have three more classes and they're all in your major and you're just going to spend your day at the Chula Vista campus, sure. But if you have a math class in the morning and a TV class in the afternoon, that could be a pretty disruptive change to your day. That's mm-hmm. like across the region.
Yeah, but as you found when you surveyed all of the mayoral candidates in Chula Vista, just something like this obviously going to be a big deal to them because mm-hmm. they have been just talking about this for decades.
30 years.
And it gotten to the point where you wondered if they were just going after windmills. Like is it too unrealistic? Is it too much of a fantasy? Or are they looking like, second rate or something, just pining for it for so long? But maybe they're going to start to get some traction for one.
Yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting. Plug in our live podcast again for PolitiFest South. It'll be interesting to talk about the candidates there, about their thoughts and if they would still want to bring a university there or would, you know, likely pursue satellite campuses instead.
Yeah. Check it out, politifest.org. Loyal listeners will remember that the California Housing and Community Development Agency is the sort of prime actor in our civic drama about the future of the sports arena land. The city owns 50 acres of land around sports arena. They want to redevelop it into housing. And it's because of the this law, the Surplus Land Act, that the Housing and Community Development Agency gets to sort of decide, or at least approve of, the city's plan to redevelop this land. The mayor has come up with a preferred partner to do that, the companies Zephyr Development, Chelsea Investment Corporation, and Legends would build the arena. That group has formed a team called Midway Village Plus. The mayor wants them to be the redevelopment partner for this land. And this week, the state agency, the HCD, said, yeah, go ahead. You got it. And also this week, Thursday, the city council's land use and housing committee met and decided that they are also okay with the mayor's choice. And so that moved on. The mayor is eager to get the city council as a whole to approve and be the sort of final approval on that, so that he can, A, his staff can enter into negotiations with them about what exactly for sure they'll build based on what they proposed, and when and how much it's all going to cost and what the city's going to have to do to help them.
But even that will be renegotated a million times over the next 3 decades and will end up being very different than anything that's been rendered so far or agreed to later.
Right.
Wipe all that stuff off your memory. It's not what's going to happen.
Right. But the second thing that he wants them to do is start to put up some cash to help the city pass Measure C now, right?
I have to say I'm not boned up on the measure letters.
I'm pretty sure it's Measure C. This is the new version of the effort to raise the height limit in the Midway area, so any of this can get done.
Yeah.
Are you all good on that? Mm-hmm. Everybody good on that?
I think you've covered it all.
All right. That means we're entering into a more overtly political stage of this situation. The two teams that didn't win this bid or didn't win the mayor's favor, and now the city council committee's backing, you're not going to believe it, aren't pleased. And now the knives are out for the winners, Midway Rising, the Zephyr. And there's been a series of news stories. La Prensa reported the other day that Midway Rising CEO Brad Termini gave a committee that was supporting the election of Mayor Todd Gloria back in 2019 and 2020, that he, Brad Termini, gave this campaign $100,000 total, a little bit more with his whole family and everything, in support of Mayor Gloria's election. And that as a developer, it's had a lot of issues before. Now, developers get sued all the time. All the time.
Well, so those were two separate stories. The one, it was a mix of they had a bunch of issues, which are, and I think there was like some concession in the story that lawsuits happen if you're involved in development. The question wasn't just that they had been sued, but that they did not disclose it as required explicitly in the RFP that said, have you ever been sued? Are there any liens against you or outstanding?
Right.
So it's like, I don't know if that you'd be okay with it if they had disclosed it, but it's like you didn't disclose it.
Yeah, it's always a thing. All right. So, but let's talk about the $100,000 for a second. So put ourselves back in
2020.
Well, it's 2019 when the committee started.
Okay.
So remember, when you run for mayor, you have your own committee you get money from. Mm-hmm. But these other things, if you're lucky, pop up. Or if you're connected, pop up to support you.
Or if you're lucky.
Yeah, yeah. They pop up to support you. Now, you can't tell them what to do.
Right.
And they can't share information with you. But you can tell people if they want to support your campaign, they can give this independent expenditure committee some money. So,
and crucially, those independent expenditure committees are not subject to the same very low contribution requirements that candidate campaigns are.
Right.
So where you, you know, $1,000 at a time for in a candidate committee, independent expenditure committee, you could donate $100,000 to.
But crucially, yeah. if you donate over a certain amount, you have to be identified as one of the major supporters. And that's what happened in this case. So the laborers union, which ended up supporting this Midway Rising plan, had this committee set up to help Todd Gloria in the primary election. Now, Todd Gloria was always going to make it through the primary election. Mm-hmm. The question was, who was going to make it through with him? Remember, there was Barbara Bree running, and Scott Sherman was running, a city councilman, a Republican. Republicans don't have a lot of voters in San Diego anymore. They have enough to get second place in a mayoral primary where there's two Democrats going at each other's throats.
Yes.
So that was that's the context here. The other context, Andy, explain to us what is happening with the sports arena at this time.
At this time, so like the process that we have all gone through that has now been discarded by the state hadn't begun yet. Now, it had, the pieces were being put in place years earlier to do this.
Yeah, Mayor Kevin Faulkner had made it an explicit point that the leases for the area were going to be expiring, and he wanted to do something like this.
And they passed a community plan that greatly increased the density of development that was allowed in the area. But it would be interesting to see the exact timing, but it's possible that Chris Kate and Jen Campbell had floated the idea of a ballot measure by this point.
To raise the height limit.
But it certainly had not been affirmatively put on the ballot yet, which didn't happen until the fall, the general election. That measure was on the ballot alongside Todd Gloria and eventually Barbara Bree.
Remember this time of year in 2020, yeah. we're hearing about a virus.
And we're like,
in the distance, like, wow.
Living life.
Yeah.
Why couldn't we get the Budweiser virus instead of the coronavirus?
It would be just like West Nile and SARS.
And that's happening. And this ad campaign starts, funded by this committee, that this man, Brad Termini, who's now received this Mayo backing for this redevelopment project, he supports this campaign that runs an ad on TV, and it knocks Barbara Bree. And I love it. It says, quote, Bree also says she'll stand up to developers, but big developers are funding her campaign. Dun, dun, dun.
But then at the bottom of that ad,
it says the name of a developer.
All right. So that's all established. Now, what you helped me remember is that was a big deal at the time. This isn't like something was hidden and came up. This was a big deal when this expenditure was made.
Yes. Barbara Bree put out a press release. Ridiculing the ad, calling Todd hypocritical, that like the allegation of hypocrisy was itself hypocritical because it was funded by a developer. And the ad was very short-lived. It was only up for a few days, is my recollection. And I believe Barbara indicated publicly that the people behind it were upset about it and asked that it be gotten rid of. No one that, to my knowledge, ever confirmed any of that. But it was up for a very short amount of time. And then that committee didn't do anything. They went home with their tail between their legs and weren't players in the rest of the primary.
In the final election, a different committee was clearly the more preferred committee from the mayor.
Yeah.
And that is what helped him get over the final.
That was the committee that they ended up doing the ads about Barbara Bree falling asleep in city council meetings.
Right.
If you remember those, and then the controversy around the ads for Barbara Bree that were tricky, right? Like sent to Republicans that made it seem like she was a Republican.
Right.
Right. The wrong universe ads.
That sent to Democrats. Acting though they're trying to promote her as a Republican, that sort of
as if it was a good thing. As if it was a good thing, but obviously you wouldn't want Democrats to know that. But anyway, that was a different committee. So this was the primary committee with the goal of sinking Bree's campaign to get Sherman through, paid for in large part by Brad Termini, this developer, but it had a very short-lived lifespan.
And obviously didn't help Sherman get through the election.
Right.
They clearly wanted Sherman to get through the election, because if he got to the runoff, Todd Gloria could run against a Republican in 2020 before Donald Trump had left office, and when around here being a Republican is even harder for a candidate to try to get over.
Yeah. So it's like, it's just all funny context to remember, because like $100,000 is a lot of money. That's, we often sort of are dismissive of campaign finance stories because, you know, like the idea that somebody is going to be bribed by like $500 into their campaign account is often a bit maybe overheated.
But
$100,000 is like a on a different scale.
Yes.
Right?
It does move a campaign.
It could move a campaign if it was done well. So it certainly warrants the increased scrutiny without question. But it is funny context to remember that it was like sort of its own disaster that ended up, I think, benefiting Bree probably more than it did Gloria in that campaign at the time.
It's hard without data, but you could make a case that was logical.
She certainly
she came out as a kind of martyr victim from it. Yes.
Yes, and she went on the offensive, right, clearly thinking that was something that was on the table. Yes.
Right. So today, yes, this comes up at the committee meeting.
Yes.
2 years later, 2+ years later, and they're like, there's Lori Saldana there, who's an opponent of the height limit increase or exemption. She's going to be at PolitiFest talking about it, by the way.
Yes, yes.
And she says, like, this is clearly like slot machine politics or whatever. Like, you're putting the money in, you're getting your deal out of it. Mm-hmm. But if you want to put that on this situation, that's quite a
jump.
Bunch of steps, mm-hmm, to be investing in.
Well, on account of the RFP, the original bidding process for developers that they competed in to develop this property, didn't happen until a few months later, and Zephyr was not part of that original competition at all. A different team won. Now, that was under Mayor Kevin Faulkner's leadership, was selected, went through, was discarded by the state over this surplus land act, you know, obscurity that caught a lot of people by surprise, started the process over, new RFP. Then Zephyr comes in and wins. So for the slot machine there, it's like,
they had to have known.
It's like a relay slot machine. It's like, you win this slot machine, take a quarter, go to the next slot machine, win that one. Take, you know, it's like four steps. Now, I think you could make a much more simple case, which is that it's not like a quid pro quo on, I gave you this donation for this deal. It's, I gave you this donation to curry favor generally. And lo and behold, you won years later. I saw an opportunity, and now.
Yeah, and we're not saying that you give $100,000 to a guy to get elected mayor because you're like
benevolent and you expect nothing out of it.
Yeah,
and
like you're trying to be part of a network that you know will benefit you, hopefully in the future, right? That's the idea. And again, she had all the candidates have people lining up around them like that. Some people do that for all the campaigns so that they have all the boxes checked.
Yes.
Right. So that's, though, I think a preview of this new sort of more political phase of this situation. So all of this, again, needs to go to the city council. City council needs to sign off on it for the mayor to get what he wants, because he wants them to sign off on it as soon as possible so that these guys, that same guy, Termini and these others, can start to fund the campaign to raise the height limit in Midway. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us.
This podcast is sponsored in part by Intesa Communications Group, a women-owned PR and government relations firm that helps you communicate and advocate with confidence. Intesa colleagues are deeply ingrained in the issues and communities you care about most. From universities and nonprofits to corporate developers, theme parks, and tech titans, Intesa helps thoughtful leaders from all sectors shape San Diego for the better. Learn more at intesacom.com. The San Diego Housing Federation's annual Ruby Awards is the county's largest affordable housing community recognition event. They'll honor the best people, projects, and achievements from the past year. Join the awards on June 6th at the Marriott Marquis San Diego Marina. Early bird pricing is available until April 12th. Secure your tickets today at housingsandiego.org. That's housingsandiego.org.
Well, also at PolitiFest, there will be a sort of debate panel with the four candidates running for San Diego Unified School District's Board of Education. There are two seats open at the board, and this is the first year where those races will be playing out within the neighborhoods that the people who want those seats are going to represent. Now, it used to be that they would run a primary in those neighborhoods, and then they'd have to run district-wide, which district-wide means basically the entirety of the city of San Diego. Now, though, this is the first year where they will only have to run and appeal to voters within their neighborhood sub-district, as it's called. And so this is sub-district B and C, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so C is coastal, kind of runs the whole length of San Diego, and sub-district B is kind of the northeastern-ish right. portion.
Those dulcet tones you just heard are from Jacob McWinney, our education reporter. He just wrapped up four profiles about those four candidates. I thought it was a great way for you to start and just learn about the district, learn about the people. You'll know those people now. One of them or two of them are going to win, so you'll know two trustees going forward.
Yeah. And
hopefully be able to hold them accountable for what they said now and such. So let's talk about the two districts first. Which areas are we talking about of the city?
Yeah, so Subdistrict C is the coastal area, runs from like Torrey Pines all the way down south. And then Subdistrict B is the more northeastern portion, kind of runs from Mission Valley, cuts down below the 8, and then runs all the way up to like the Scripps Ranch area, although Scripps Ranch was moved into a different sub-district. With the last kind of redistricting of these sub-districts.
Got it. Let's start with the coast.
Okay.
So we've got two really interesting candidates there. Tell us about them.
Yeah. So on the coast, you know, whereas sub-district B is both of the candidates there kind of agree on a lot of what the priorities and needs for education in San Diego are. The coast really is kind of a tale of opposites. We have Becca Williams, who is a Republican, been endorsed by a lot of the conservative kind of politicians in the area. And then there is Cody Pedersen, who is a longtime Democratic activist. He works on kind of education, land use, this smorgasbord of different issues for Supervisor Tara Lawson-Reamer. Mm-hmm. And they are quite different, really. You know, Becca, some of her big issues have been pushing back against the way the district responded to COVID. You know, she's made a lot of allies with some of the folks like Reopen San Diego and Let Them Breathe, who were some of the folks really at the forefront of fighting to reopen San Diego, despite the fact that really not a whole lot had closed. You know, she's made a lot of allies there. Recently spoke at an event during which Sharon McKeeman, the leader of Let Them Breathe, announced her candidacy for Carlsbad School Board. She's also really wanted to push back against some of the things that have been adopted in the name of equity. She feels that not only is equity not really fully defined, but some of the things have started to kind of dumb down education in a way that harms kids.
She has a background in charter schools, right?
Yes.
She helped start and run some of them in Texas.
Yes.
They were known for that sort of classical teaching, right?
So exactly.
They focus on just math and science and...
Yeah, classical. So classical that they teach Latin at the schools that...
Right.
You know, she started in Texas. So her background in charter schools, she acknowledges, you know, charter schools, or she believes that charter schools are a pretty useful way to diversify education in a way that answers the needs of specific communities as opposed to a more district-wide sort of program. She has said she doesn't think that she will be able to turn the district into a pro charter district. For a long time, it's been pretty, I don't know about hostile, but has definitely pushed back quite significantly against the expansion of certain charter schools.
Yeah, it's definitely, its history was one of the first to truly embrace and fund and help expand the concept of charter schools for mm-hmm. a long time. The idea that they would experiment and find solutions to education and then spread those to the rest of the schools. And then it became a more controversial issue and the tide really turned to hostility to them.
Yeah.
However, the charter schools support the district's new tax increase bond measure that's going out, and the district's stoked about that.
Yeah.
And promised them a significant chunk of that money when and if taxpayers support it. So it's always a little odd to say it's anti-charter school when they want to give them that much support, but it's also clearly not interested in approving more or helping them scale out a lot more.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty muddy concept, really. But that the bond measure was another, you know, in a long line of differences between them. You know, Becca does not support it. Cody does. And there are lots of things that Cody also supports that are just, again, very opposite of what Becca does. He feels like ethnic studies in schools are absolutely vital. And, you know, a couple of years ago, San Diego chose to require ethnic studies for graduation. It had already become, or the state had already decided that it would become a requirement to graduate, but San Diego instituted that requirement on a faster timetable than the state had. He's very supportive of the community schools concept, which would essentially provide wraparound services that answer some of the needs kids may have outside of the classroom, whether that's mental health or you know, meals. And he is really a funding guy. You know, he's done a lot of work advocating for different funding solutions and feels that he wants to not only feels that he not only wants to increase funding per pupil, but that he will be able to based on some of the connections he's made locally and statewide.
Yeah, I loved your profile of him because it really captured this like deeply academic and intellectual person who traveled the world and is distraught about the state of things and wonders if it's all too late to fix all these things that he's worried about and inequity and climate change, and yet thinks he can change them, you know, by getting in at this level and going forward. I thought that was really interesting. And you captured her really well too, because I think what's interesting about what I got from her is she's really trying to ride this line of there was a popular backlash to the closing of in-person schools.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And, you know, I felt that very acutely in our kids and how much they struggled. And my daughter loved going to school and now does not love going to school. Mm-hmm. And I really do blame it on what happened. You know, it's just a mm-hmm. really hard period.
Yeah.
But she's trying to capture that from people like me while also kind of riding the tide of the folks who clearly want something more dramatic to happen to schools.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it's kind of scary, frankly, about how angry and how much how many books they want to get rid of, how many mm-hmm. like other causes they are adopting that is troublesome. So it's like, do you feel like she's managing that balance well?
I think as well as she can. I think that 2022 probably isn't the year that these sorts of positions are going to be winning ones. Maybe 2021 or 2020, when those things were much more acute and people were sitting there and looking at their kids, you know, elementary school age kids doing virtual learning. I'm sure it would have resonated a lot more then. But like you said, she is sort of trying to tap into not only the backlash to the pandemic, but also some of the other more broader kind of right-wing culture war issues. You know, there was this really interesting mailer that I found that was sent out to Republican donors that basically advertised her as, you know, the anti-woke candidate who is going to make sure that kids have this love for America, and, you know, implied that it would be this anti-CRT sort of thing. And so that CRT panic, even though it's
critical race
theory. You know, I think that critical race theory often what it aims to do is acknowledge the inequities that exist in larger systems. It isn't necessarily saying, oh, you're white, so you're racist. It's that these systems were built by privileged people and now exert that privilege in ways that unequally affect people of color or marginalized communities. And you know, it can be a frustrating thing to talk about because while clearly elementary schoolers are not being taught this legal framework and concept, I personally think that it's a useful thing for everybody to understand. It seems pretty uncontroversial to me that these inequities exist and that they have existed from the inception of many of the systems that govern this country. But at the same time, there are elements of this sort of greater understanding of privilege that exist in things like ethnic studies. And I think that people should lean into that. But there is a large kind of right-wing movement that really wants to push back against this under the guise that it is sort of, again, you know, putting the blame for things that happened 50, 100 years, 200 years ago on people who are living now. And in addition to that, sort of undermining this kind of love of country or patriotism that they feel should exist if we're going to continue being this country.
Yeah, in its dumbest version, they're saying, like, your kid is going to be taught to hate the way she is
exactly,
or who she yeah. is because of
this, ashamed to be white or
this
whatever.
Diversity education that they're getting or something. So, yeah, it's a fascinating balance to try to maintain. And then you have Cody, though, and I'm kind of surprised that this didn't take off a little bit more. He said in your profile, this is a global quote, this is a global pandemic. Closing schools was both good for students and it was very, very good for teachers. That's like kind of a big statement. I wouldn't mm-hmm. doubt if that's on a lot of her mailers, if she can afford them to send out, because
oh, I'm she not can. She's done very well fundraising wise.
Yeah. And so then that's the question, like, is closing schools was both good for students and very, very good for teachers? I mean, I know what he's saying there, that he protected them or that it protected them mm-hmm. from disease and from, you know, potential, you know, even death. But closing schools was both good. That's just a hard thing for people who struggled through that period with their kids mm-hmm. to kind of take. And so I wonder how well that will resonate as well. But he also, when you ask him, like, how are you going to fix some of the problems there? It does go back to like a kind of, well, we're just going to get more and more money. Mm-hmm. Did he answer or talk about like how much money the district has been getting and whether it was adequate or is that just not even a point of, you know, assumption?
You know, we didn't get into that too much. I think that's something that probably will be useful in the future to get into. But he had a lot of strategies, you know, whether it was feathering in things over summer school that could help kids transition from one grade to the next. But as you said, a lot of those require money, and who knows whether the district feels that they have enough to take on these new strategies. But yeah, that quote, it was an interesting one, and I can see how it could easily be spun. You know, he was in context very clearly talking about, as you said, the infection potential of older people who are very clearly shown to be at higher risk for serious complications when it comes to COVID. But it'll be interesting to see how this campaign continues. You know, thus far, I think it's been very... They both in interviews have expressed their happiness that it's been fairly cordial. I doubt that it will continue to be that way as we get closer to election day.
Well, stay tuned. Go to PolitiFest and see how that turns out there. So the other race, if you were to kind of put a candidate together, it'd be hard to put one together better than Shayna Hazen, right?
Mm-hmm. Hazen.
Hazen, mm-hmm. excuse me. Because she's got, it seems like everything put together well. She's got the money, she's got the endorsements, she's really well-spoken on these issues, she's got a lot of perspective. She was a mother who worked through the PTA system. Mm-hmm. Did you see any vulnerabilities in her campaign as you interviewed her?
How well put together she is may in and of itself be a vulnerability. I think people tend to like underdogs. Mm-hmm. And I think...
And there's a big one running against her.
Exactly.
Godwin yeah. Higa?
Godwin Higa, yeah. He's raised $5,000 to her $103,000 thus far. So to call him an underdog would be very fair. Also because she, even in the primary, got more than 50% of the vote, double what he got. So it seems like it's at this point her race to lose.
He might be an underdog. She's her profession literally was to raise money. So she mm-hmm. knows how yeah. to put together good campaigns. She has an understanding of at least what she says she would want to do to pursue evidence-based, you know, reforms to schools mm-hmm. and help them be better. She's got the teachers union support. It kind of surprised me as the way she started with her parent-focused kind of vision, mm-hmm. but that's how good she is at pulling together this coalition. But he has a really interesting story. Like he said, he grew up and experienced a lot of trauma as a kid yeah. and brought that to his own schools when he became a principal and an educator and was on the forefront, as you described, of adopting an understanding and what would you call it, a trauma-informed school where people
yeah, exactly.
can understand the trauma that these kids go through at their home life and making sure that they don't experience more in the future at the school and can kind of accommodate that a little bit and help them learn in the process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, he has a really interesting story. And he's a really, you know, they're both very kind people, but Godwin has this warmth that's really interesting. And from... You know, all accounts, he was a very warm, thoughtful principal. You know, I got comments on the piece from people saying, you know, Godwin was the principal at my kid's school and everybody loved him. He was really, really good with the kids. And even before he had the sort of terminology to describe trauma-informed schools, he was using strategies like teaching to the whole child, which again embraces kind of all of the social emotional learning that goes on as opposed to just in the classroom.
Like at its basic level, they need food. Mm-hmm. They can't learn without
yeah.
with being hungry. Mm-hmm. But also there's a lot of other things going on in their lives you might want to help them with if you want them to learn more too.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, he worked with a lot of community organizations to bring in resources, whether it was food or mental health supports. But at a certain point, this journalist, Jane Stevens, came to the last school that he was principal of, Cherokee Point, and basically told him, you know, spent a couple days there, walked around and said, you know, Godwin, did you know that you have a trauma-informed school? And he was like, what is that? And she started to explain to him this thing called ACEs, which are adverse childhood experiences. And basically what those are, it came actually from a study just down the street in San Diego. Those are basically instances of potential trauma that kids have had in their lives growing up that can potentially drastically affect the development, not only of their personality, but of their physical brain. And can potentially make it harder for them to learn. It can put them at a greater risk of engaging in risky behaviors later on. And once he had this terminology, I think it really sort of focused his drive to continue these sort of trauma-informed approaches at schools. And he was celebrated for that, for sure. So he does have this story of being, you know, not only on the ground, but in administration and having run schools and this long history with San Diego Unified that I think could resonate with people.
Well, check out Jacob's profiles on these four candidates. I thought they were great. At voicesandiego.org. And of course, come and see all four of them at PolitiFest and go to politifest.org. Thanks, Jacob.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast that puts on its own public affairs sort of festival. You might call it PolitiFest every year. And it's just amazing. So we are the most popular public affairs podcast that does that as well. Get the newsletter for this show and all our great columns at vosd.org/newsletters. That's vosd.org/newsletters. You can get the politics report, the learning curve, the North County report, all of those. vosd.org/newsletters. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice of San Diego. Andrew Keats is managing editor. Andrea Lopez Villafana is also managing editor. Nate John is our excellent producer. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.